Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
We've all seen the horrific images coming out of Haiti.
I'm hoping I don't have to go to Haiti to bury aunts and uncles or nephews.
Children laying on the sidewalk that had died and somebody just left them there.
Very deep lacerations, parts of their skulls gone.
But through the devastation and despair, we also hear the stubborn voice of hope.
We will go through a lot, but we will not be broken. We will not be hopeless. That's our story.
Lessons in resilience from those who endure. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 14th, and The Takeaway for me is if you're looking for a lesson in resilience, one could hardly look further than Haiti.
No, and they're definitely learning lessons this morning. We're also going to be talking about lessons from the bank disaster. Elizabeth Warren joins us in just a few moments, but let's get to the top story we're following, the sound of rescue in Haiti. It's an improvised operation at this point as the wave of international relief efforts just begins to arrive. Pickup trucks being used as ambulances, doors as stretchers, thousands of Haitians trying to free those injured in the earthquake by hand.
I know there's a lot of people under the building collapse, a lot of traffic, people crying.
The death toll remains an unknown, but appears to be in the tens of thousands. Bob Poff of the Salvation Army says besides donating money or supplies, there's something you can do.
People can help by caring about what happens in Haiti, by paying attention, by holding all of us accountable. Don't let our story die when it goes off the wire.
The pace of relief efforts appears to be picking up. So far this morning, a 60-member earthquake relief team arrived from China with 10 tons of supplies. Three French planes have also arrived with aid in a mobile hospital. A U.S. destroyer is now anchored off the Haitian coast, while an aircraft carrier with supplies and 2,000 Marines arrives later this morning. The priority for these teams is saving lives, looking for survivors in the mountains of rubble, as well as providing food, water, medical care, and shelter. Bill Horan, the president of the group Operation Blessing International, says his group is on the ground and helping out.
We set up these small plants that process 10,000 gallons per day. We can take water from a river, from a pond.
Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Lucy Tontreau. She's a Haitian community advocate in Miami, Florida. She was hoping to join the relief effort in Haiti today, but has yet to get clearance to travel.
It's the feeling of helplessness right here in South Florida that is the hardest part.
If you want to donate to the relief effort that's needed in Haiti, go to our website, thetakeaway.org. In other news, retail sales dropped 0.3% in December. Sales for all of 2009 plunged by a record amount. In labor, new claims for unemployment insurance rose more than expected, while continuing claims have fallen.
And those stats are moving the markets at this point. The futures have turned down slightly, and oil is trading just below $80 a barrel at this point. Asian markets were mixed this morning. European indices are up. Futures are up. Or futures actually have flattened out. The Dow gets underway now at 10,680. The S&P opens at 1,145. And the NASDAQ opens at 2307. And investors were watching the bankers who faced the music yesterday in front of the Financial Meltdown Commission investigation that opened in Washington. Elizabeth Warren, who's in charge of the Oversight Commission on the TARP and the financial bailout, is going to join us in just a moment. And in the wake of Haiti's devastating earthquakes, we're asking you, what is the responsibility of the world's richest nation?
I think that we should have the responsibility to take care of Haiti, so long as we were the people that helped cause the wealth disproportionality that caused the hospital collapses in the first place.
As Jeff Klein from Massachusetts, do you agree with him, or do you have your own ideas? Should America be shouldering the financial burden of the relief effort? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are going to get Elizabeth Warren's take on the Financial Inquiry Commission in Washington in just a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Yesterday was the first day of hearings from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It's a year-long investigation into what caused the financial crisis and supposedly how we can avoid such a thing from happening again. Today, the commission will hear from administration officials. Here's the commission's chairman, Phil Angelides, pressing Goldman Sachs' chief executive.
What I'd like to ask you is, can you tell me very specifically what are the two most significant instances of negligent, improper, and bad behavior in which your firm engaged and for which you would apologize?
I think we, in our behavior, got caught up in and participated and therefore contributed to elements of froth in the market.
Joining us now, we welcome back Elizabeth Warren, chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel and the Leo Gottlieb Professor at Harvard Law School. She joins us from the Senate. Good morning.
Good morning.
What were you listening for when you listened to these hearings yesterday? What were you hoping to hear?
I was hoping to hear that these CEOs would say, we really messed this up, and we manipulated markets, and we manipulated consumers. We sold lousy products. We understood that it was not a sustainable market, and we're ready to change our ways. But, that didn't happen.
That did not happen. What we just heard right there was Blank Fine specifically not answering the question of the committee.
I thought he answered it. You know, he said too much froth. He sounds
froth.
Like a froth. He says I was a bad barista.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but that's not acknowledging negligence. He asked him to acknowledge negligence, and he did not do that.
And he didn't do that. Of course he did not do that.
We talked earlier to Peter Solomon. He's the founder and chairman of the independent investment bank Peter J. Solomon Company. And this is what he had to say.
This was a colossal management failure. The firms that really became a debacle, Lehman and Bear Stearns, they were incredibly bad. But even the major banks admitted that they failed in terms of management. One of the things they failed in, they just had too much hubris. They believed that their systems were so sophisticated that they could weather any storm. It turned out they couldn't.
Elizabeth Warren, do you agree? Do you think that the banks have admitted failure of management and that the root cause of all this was hubris?
Now, I think that the banks don't admit it. I think that that's really the problem here. I think the banks say we are the best and brightest. That's why we deserve these gorgeous salaries. We make the American economic engine run. We know everything. And then out of the other side of their mouths, they say, we knew nothing. We didn't understand what was going to be the consequence of selling millions of mortgages to people who didn't qualify for them and were not possibly going to be able to repay them. We had no idea that telling people a product was great and selling it out the front door while we bet against it by short selling it out the back door would cause any problems or might destabilize anything. I mean, I think the bottom line is they'll say whatever they want to say, and I don't think that's admitting that there's something wrong. I think the rest of us can acknowledge that there's a problem with these banks, but the banks haven't done it.
Well, but what's the regulatory takeaway here? This is the thing that I have a real problem with. I mean, it's actually standard operating procedure in finance to make one bet and then make a side bet to hedge your bet, and this is what these guys do all the time. And their argument that, hey, we're okay, so therefore what we did was right, is kind of capitalism 101. How do you regulate them to steer away from those kinds of risks or to do excessive hedging without completely transforming the whole idea of what investment bankers do?
Well, let me answer it actually in two ways, because the other part I want to say is, you know, we're focused on the banks, and boy, I'm glad to focus on the banks. They deserve every ounce of attention you give to them. But let's remember, too, the regulators failed profoundly here. The federal regulators who were responsible for ensuring the safety and soundness of those financial institutions, for monitoring those institutions to make sure that they were not taking on too much risk so that we would avoid this kind of catastrophe, they fell down on the job, and they deserve scrutiny. They need to be hauled in, and we need to figure out what went wrong here, because they failed to enforce the laws that were on the book. And then collectively, we failed to provide more regulators. You know, as this whole industry ballooned, we didn't increase the number of regulators, and we sure didn't increase their pay, even as the people they regulated were making more and more money and, you know, just moving off into more and more complex activities. And we failed to change the law to cover these innovations, these new activities. So we had a profound regulatory failure, one that is almost as magnificent as the failure of the banking industry itself. It's as if the regulators and the banks held hands while they jumped over the cliff together. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around here. Now, if the question you're asking is it ever possible to regulate? I think the answer is yes. We did it for a very long time. Remember, we went through boom and bust cycles from, starting at 1794, every 10 to 15 years. We'd build a boom and then there'd be a crash and a lot of people would get wiped out. We hit the Great Depression in the 1930s. And the folks who were in government at that point said, we can do better than this. We can put some regulation in place. And we put three basic regulations in place: FDIC insurance to make it safe to put money in banks, Glass-Steagall to say that the banks that take deposits cannot engage in risky trading, and SEC regulations to try to make that market a little more honest. And it served us for more than 50 years. We didn't have a single financial crisis in 50 years. And then what happened? We started deregulating. We started pulling out the threads. And we ended up with the savings and loan debacle. What did we do? We kept deregulating. We ended up with long-term capital management. We kept deregulating.
It was the hedge fund that went out of business, sure.
Exactly. We then end up with Enron, which, remember the lesson from Enron? The books are dirty. They're lying to us in the accounting.
But this
and
argues...
we kept on deregulating. This is in part... the system we build.
But we keep hearing, I've heard from journalists who say that it's too late, that we've missed our chance at reform. And then we hear from politicians that say, no, there's plenty of time. Which is it? Have we missed the opportunity to pass some serious reform?
Look, all I can say is I can't answer the political question. I don't know what it takes to get Washington moving. I'm not a Washington person. I'm a teacher, ultimately. But I can say this. We desperately need reform. If we don't get reform, we're headed back into the boom and bust cycle game. And every, 10 to 15 years, we'll keep playing this game. And part of the world will get richer and richer, and the rest of us will continue to get wiped out.
Elizabeth Warren, chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel, and Leo Gottlieb, professor at Harvard Law School. Thank you very much. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look now at the headlines.
Oh, she wants to go back to Glass-Steagall. That's a huge headline right there. But anyway, in the top story that we're following, the Department of Homeland Security says it's halting deportations of Haitians back to the island for the time being. Immigration advocates say the U.S. should grant temporary protective status that would allow Haitians already in America to stay here. Meanwhile, the U.S. is working hard to mobilize relief teams to Haiti. General Douglas Fraser, the commander of U.S. Southern Command, says the military is considering sending more troops.
We're looking at the possibility of sending a large deck amphibious ship that will have a Marine Expeditionary Unit embarked on that.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has cut her visit to the Asia-Pacific region to deal with the crisis. She said the death toll is going to be massive.
We know that there will be tens of thousands of casualties. We don't have any exact numbers now.
Moving on to other news, Democratic leaders returned to the White House today to continue negotiations over the health care bill. President Obama makes his own push with an afternoon visit to Capitol Hill. And the president is expected to announce a new 10-year tax on the country's largest banks. Officials are calling it a financial crisis responsibility fee. It's meant to cover a projected $117 billion shortfall in the Wall Street bailout fund. Also, a few more economic stories today. Falling demand led to a disappointing end to the sales year. The Commerce Department says retail sales dropped 0.3% in December. Meanwhile, the number of newly laid off workers rose again last week. The Labor Department says first-time claims for unemployment benefits were up by 11,000. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to look at the start of the Haitian relief effort with Mark Lacey of the New York Times. He's just touched ground in Port-au-Prince.
Hey, you want that to go?
So joining us now is Todd Zwillick with our news takeout. And Haiti is a focus in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers have had 36 hours to digest the news. President Obama said yesterday he's mobilized teams to reach Haiti as soon as possible. Some have already arrived. Todd Zwillick, what's going on?
Well, most of the focus, John, right now is at the Pentagon and at the White House. Capitol Hill won't step in on this stuff until it's time to spend some money, although some senators are already asking the leadership to make Haiti and relief efforts the first order of business when the Senate returns next week. He's not a Marine. Air Force General Douglas Fraser, who's commander of SOUTHCOM, the Southern Command, is in command of this operation and briefed the press yesterday. We've mentioned earlier in the hour, John, that the USS Carl Vinson, which is a large nuclear aircraft carrier, is steaming towards Haiti right now. There's also a flat-top amphibious ship with Marines on board. And then there may be other U.S. military personnel heading down there, Fraser said. This depends on what military assessment teams find. There are assessment teams probably arriving right now or later on this morning. And they need to find out the situation on the ground and sort of the operational terrain in Port-au-Prince before a brigade of Army troops from Fort Bragg or another Marine brigade is sent down there, which is also a possibility. There are Coast Guard cutters and also C-130s.
And there does appear to be consensus on Capitol Hill that this is a worthy investment. This is exactly what the military is supposed to be doing in situations like this. There's obviously a long tradition of relief operations, but lots of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle complain about nation building as a Pentagon mission.
Yeah, I think at this stage, John, that really in these early times, the focus is on finding and digging. No one on Capitol Hill has said anything other than full support for that. And I think with the amount of devastation that's become clear, it's early days. And of course, these things always get tied up in fights over money. But in these days, no one is voicing anything but 100% support for what the White House and the military are trying to do.
You know, I want to shift gears here for a moment because something that happened yesterday is really part of the buzz down there on Capitol Hill, and I know you're aware of it. A lot of people we talk to from Haiti describe quite openly, you know, their concern that somehow Haiti has a cloud hanging over it, that its historical legacy of disasters and political instability somehow has created a sort of bullseye in the hearts of Haitians. People asking on this program, why Haiti? Well, Pat Robertson of the Christian Broadcasting Network had a fairly grim answer to that question yesterday.
Something happened a long time ago in Haiti, and people might not want to talk about it. They were under the heel of the French, Napoleon III and whatever. And they got together and swore a pact to the devil. They said, we will serve you if you'll get us free from the French. It's a true story.
That's Pat Robertson saying that the Haitians made a deal with the devil, Todd?
Yeah, that is what he said.
Presidential candidate.
Yeah, not a ton of reaction on Capitol Hill. One lawmaker from Miami did react yesterday and say, we need relief and digging people out, food and water. We don't need recriminations or analysis from Pat Robertson. He has a long history of this,
yeah.
I think he said something similar after 9/11 and similar after Katrina, so maybe not such a big surprise.
And, in terms of his status within the conservative movement?
Good question. I think we should find out after a remark like that what his status
All
is.
Right. I can hear you stepping away from this very, very carefully. Todd Zwillick, our savvy and smart Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
We're going to bring back a guest now that we spoke with yesterday. Mallory Thurwell is the founder and director of Haiti Against Poverty from Grand Rapids, Michigan. We spoke to you yesterday, Mallory, because you were trying desperately to reach your boyfriend. We got you in touch with him on the air, but you have had no contact with him since, correct?
Correct. No, I am still so thankful that you were able to do that. I don't know how I would have gotten through the day yesterday without hearing his voice.
Well, are you sure that he's still okay and safe and sound?
I did hear from someone yesterday that they were able to speak with him about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he seemed pretty panicked. He was not hurt, but, I mean, he has no structure to go to. He has no house. He did find his brothers, but he was sleeping on the streets. He had not had food or water yet since the earthquake began, and he was just frantic on the phone saying that no one's here yet, no one's helping, when are they coming? There's just people dying all around me, when are they going to be here?
The other thing that occurred yesterday was that while we connected you with him, with Franz Neptune, on our air, he had to break the news to you that you'd lost an 18-month-old baby that was very close to you. Have you had to get news like that in similar ways?
Yes, unfortunately, yesterday was a day filled with bad news, one after another. The orphanage that we thought was standing, that we partner with over 40 children, did collapse, and we have no idea of the condition of the children inside. And this next week, I was planning on going to Haiti. I had a ticket through American Airlines to get down there on Thursday morning and to bring back a small child. She weighs 12 pounds, but she's 2 years old, for a life-saving heart surgery. And I found out yesterday that she has been lost in the rubble as well.
Mallory Thruell from Grand Rapids, Michigan. My heart and the hearts of the rest of America goes out to you. Good luck. In the wake of Haiti's devastating earthquake, what do you think is the responsibility of the world's richest nation?
The United States of America cannot be blamed for the Haiti situation, and we cannot be saving the world. I agree we need humanitarian efforts, but please, let's not come back and bash the United States of America.
Should America be shouldering more of the financial burden for the relief effort, or do you agree with Bob from Rhode Island that we're not responsible? What's your take? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org or on our website, thetakeaway.org.
You know, my thoughts go back to Mallory there. She's a relief worker on her way to Haiti to actually help with the relief operation, but also dealing with some very personal grief of her own. A lot of people in America in that very same situation. Coming up, lessons from the banks who faced the music yesterday in Washington. But first, let's check the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Help has been arriving in Port-au-Prince, Haiti this morning. The World Food Program says damage to the city's port is preventing ship deliveries and is complicating efforts to bring the relief effort into Port-au-Prince. Joining us now is Mark Lacey, New York Times Caribbean correspondent who has landed in Port-au-Prince. Mark, are you there?
Extremely faint.
Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Just describe what you're seeing right now.
Okay, I just arrived at the Port-au-Prince Airport. The scene coming in, looking over Port-au-Prince from the air, is stunning. Rooftops are down across the city. Big buildings, small shanties, all sized. The roofs are in. The damage from this earthquake is profound, and you can see it from the air coming in. I'm now standing on the tarmac. It's extremely busy here. There are cargo planes arriving from around the world. There are relief supplies that are beginning to be unloaded. Not far from me, there are dozens of search and rescue workers from Fairfax, Virginia, who are grabbing their gear and starting their work. So the relief effort, the recovery effort, is apparent here at the airport.
There, you're hearing it and seeing it through the eyes of Mark Lacey, the Caribbean correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, who's just on the tarmac there at Port-au-Prince Airport, describing the relief operation and the stunning destruction.
If you want to donate to the relief effort, you can always go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Let's take a quick look at the markets. The Dow is down about 4 points, the NASDAQ about 1 point, and the S&P also down about 1 point right now. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
And investors on Wall Street last night were very interested in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It kicked off its hearings yesterday. Bank CEOs were the first ones to testify, and Chairman Phil Angelides laid out the issue that's really the central question in this whole investigation right at the top of the hearings.
One of the issues we must explore is, was this purely a perfect storm, or was it a man-made perfect storm in which the clouds receded?
Man-made or an act of God, the financial meltdown? We talked earlier today with Peter Solomon, founder and chairman of the independent investment bank, Peter J. Solomon Company. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So there's the issue. Was this some kind of a act of God, this financial meltdown that was unavoidable, that no one could have seen? Or was it an act of men and women who made decisions that led us down this road? First of all, that seems to be what they're exploring. Where do you come down on this?
Well, I testified yesterday in front of the commission in response to the testimony of the four CEOs. I think the chairman first did a terrific job, I should tell you that, and I think it's a very serious and important commission. Equal to issues like the 9/11 or the Pecoric Commission or other commissions before it. There's no question in my mind it was man-made. There was nothing destined to happen here. This was all acts. As I said to the commission, there's so many villains in this that if you listed them all, you could never get to the plot. Hmm.
You know, you mentioned the PCORA Commission. That commission investigated J.P. Morgan, among other bankers, decades ago. How do you explain, if you believe that this was a man-made disaster, Peter Solomon, how do you explain this exchange between Chairman Angelides and Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs? Listen.
One of the issues we must explore is, was this purely a perfect storm, or was it a man-made perfect storm in which the clouds receded?
Actually, it's the next cut. Number 12, play that one, all right?
I'm just going to be blunt with you. It sounds to me a little bit like selling a car with faulty brakes and then buying an insurance policy on the buyer of those cars. It doesn't seem to me that that's a practice that inspires confidence in the markets.
Every
I'm not talking about your own positions.
Every
I'm talking about betting against
of an
the security.
Asset here is an institution, professional-only investors dedicated, in most cases, to this business.
Representing pension funds who have the life savings of police officers,
these
teachers.
Are the professional investors who want this exposure.
Now, in sort of unpacking that and getting, you know, sort of decoding it for regular old listeners out there, Peter Solomon, it seems to me that Lloyd Blankfein is saying it's our job to take sometimes outlandish risks. That's what we do. We're the professionals here. But Angelides is saying, no, you're being reckless. You've done something fundamentally wrong. Is that a resolvable dilemma?
Yeah, I don't think either of them are. If you phrase it in that phrase, neither of them are totally correct. Let's not focus on that for a minute. Let's focus on how we got into the situation, which is your first question. And that question, everybody agreed on there. Let's focus on what people agreed on, that there was too much leverage, that there was too much risk, that management matters, and better managements did better and worse managements did worse, that there was too much funding of long-term investments, such as real estate by Lehman Brothers, and short-term borrowings to fund those investments. So one of the issues here was there was firms ran out of liquidity. And that's why the government had to hop in. And then finally, or not finally, there are many other reasons, there was really bad application of existing regulation. One of the real issues that's going to be debated is, should there be more regulation? I'm sure there will be more. I think there should be more. But it's not the real issue is government failed as well. The regulators failed, Congress failed, administrations failed. They all permitted this storm to come along, and they're all equally to blame.
Except Peter Solomon, that brings us back to Phil Angelides, one of his tortured metaphors yesterday, that it's like, you know, Murder on the Orient Express. Everyone did it. So that's just
correct.
The same as saying no one did it. I mean, is it possible in an environment where profits produce a sense that everything's okay, that we can ever effectively regulate? Because during the times these banks were doing really, really well, that was exactly the moment that they were setting themselves up to fail so spectacularly.
Yes, but that's the yin and yang of capitalism within a regulated world. You either have unfettered capitalism or you have fettered capitalism, as it were.
And well, where do you put the fetters? It seems to me that's the key point.
You put the fettered in state and local regulation. And I should add one other thing. You put it in management. This was a colossal management failure. The firms that really became a debacle, Lehman and Bear Stearns, they were incredibly bad. But even the major banks admitted that they failed in terms of management. One of the things they failed in, they just had too much hubris. They believed that their systems were so sophisticated that they could weather any storm. It turned out they couldn't.
But there's no accountability here. I mean, the people from Lehman and Bear Stearns, they don't have jobs anymore, most of them, unless they were hired by Goldman Sachs. As you're saying, that Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan are significantly to blame here, but they're fine. Their banks still exist, and they're all going to get significant bonuses. It seems to me the difference between the banks that failed and the banks that succeeded is huge from the perspective that I'm looking at, but these guys aren't getting punished who are in front of Congress at all. There's no accountability for them.
Well, I don't think that's exactly right. We don't have enough time to explore that question you asked. That question's going to take the commission a year to answer. But I think everybody who had their hand up and is in the front page of the New York Times and other places swearing and being excoriated by the commission is paying some price. There is no question that other people are paying a larger price. I'm not justifying their actions, but I don't think it's a simple I don't think you can be as simple in your in the analysis as you're implying.
Well, thanks for the great discussion, Peter Solomon. The commission is going to try to get to the bottom of this, simple or not. Peter Solomon is founder and chairman of the independent investment bank Peter J. Solomon Company, and he was one of the people who testified before the commission. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, hundreds of thousands of Haitians in the U.S. are still unable to reach their relatives in Haiti. Later this hour, we'll talk with members of the Haitian community in the U.S. about the difficulties. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is infantry soldier specialist Mark Hall.
Yeah, I did a good thing. I'm back from Iraq. I served my country. The only thing on my mind right now is to get down and serve big time with family.
Mark Hall has been in jail since December 11th because of this rap song. He wrote it after he was told he would be deployed to Iraq for another year-long tour. He'd expected to be out of the Army by February. That's when his term of service was supposed to end, but that's not what ended up happening. That's why the lyrics blast the Army and its stop-loss policy, but they also describe Specialist Hall going on a shooting spree. And in the wake of Fort Hood's tragedy, Hall's commanders decided to be extra cautious, and they jailed him. The military is expected to decide in the coming days whether they will charge him or not. We're joined this morning by Mark Hall's civil lawyer, Jim Klimaski. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is Specialist Hall charged with?
Well, he's charged with making threats, one of which is based on the song, but it's very difficult to understand what the charges are. They drafted the charge sheet, I think, very quickly to avoid the issue of him deciding whether or not he's going to go to Iraq again.
Well, here's the portion of the song that actually got him into trouble.
Still against the wall, I grab my M4, spray and watch all the bodies hit the floor. I bet you never stop, lost nobody no more. In your next lifetime, of course, no remorse.
That's him describing himself taking his M4 and going on a spree in protest against the stop-loss policy. Is that not a threat?
Well, you have to listen to the whole song. I mean, the song is really about stop-loss and what's wrong with the program. And I think like almost 200,000 soldiers have been stop-lossed over these wars so far. The Army keeps saying they're going to stop the program, and they claim they have several times, but they keep doing it. And he wrote this song in protest. He wrote this song back in the summer. They've known about this song for a long time. This is not anything new to them. He didn't do anything after writing the song. They know that. They've talked with him. They didn't feel threatened by him. They sent him on training to California with the unit. So the idea that all of a sudden now they feel threatened, I don't think that that's true.
So do you think that the military is just overreacting to the Fort Hood tragedy? Is that what I hear you saying?
I'm not going to say the word overreacting. I think that they felt they were in a bind and decided, well, the best way we can get out of the bind is put him in jail. So they charged him.
And what will be his defense?
That he didn't threaten anybody and nobody felt threatened. That this is a song and he has a First Amendment right to say that.
But Jim Klimaski, does the military have any special powers to suspend freedom of speech?
Well, I mean, he can't say it in uniform, he can't speak for the Army, but he's not speaking for the Army. He's speaking for himself. And he wasn't in uniform writing this song or publishing it.
Okay, we're talking about Specialist Mark Hall, who is in jail right now for the rap song he wrote, in which he described going on a shooting spree. The specialist was supposed to be at home from Iraq when his term of service ended, but he was redeployed because of the stop-loss program. We talked to Jim Klimaski, D.C.-based civil lawyer who represents Specialist Mark Hall. You can hear the entire song at our website, thetakeaway.org.
Listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, direct news from Haiti. We speak with a woman who runs an orphanage about 12 miles from the palace in Port-au-Prince on what's going on in terms of relief efforts. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Aid is flowing into Haiti at a brisker pace. Chinese and French planes arrived this morning, and a British rescue team is expected this evening. This afternoon, an American aircraft carrier is due to arrive, and more Navy ships are on the way as well. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says it's still too early to make a firm estimate on deaths, but expects the toll to be in the tens of thousands. Meanwhile, 2 days after the earthquake, survivors continue to search debris and scramble for basic help. The director for disaster services at the Salvation Army, Bob Poff, urged people to continue providing support and attention.
People can help by caring about what happens in Haiti, by paying attention, by holding all of us accountable. Don't let our story die when it goes off the wires.
And as the world looks for ways to help the victims, the FBI is warning people to watch out for aid scams, unsolicited appeals for money that you find on the internet. If you want to donate to the relief effort, we have a list of credible relief organizations on our website at thetakeaway.org.
In other news, President Obama is expected to propose a new tax on big banks to cover a projected $117 billion shortfall in the Wall Street bailout fund. A senior official says it would apply to financial companies with assets of more than $50 billion. Market holding on to gains, kind of a flat opening on Wall Street this morning. The Dow is up about 10 points. The NASDAQ and the S&P are up fractionally. Today is the second day of hearings into the financial crisis. Attorney General Eric Holder is expected to tell the panel the Justice Department is using every tool at its disposal to fight the financial crimes that contributed to the meltdown. Almost 3 million homeowners received at least one foreclosure filing during 2009. That sets a new record for the number of people falling behind on their mortgage payments. The Centers for Disease Control says that the percentage of very overweight Americans may have leveled off. The numbers indicate the obesity rates have remained constant for at least 5 years among men and nearly 10 years for women and children. And an R&B legend has died. Teddy Pendergrass' passionate vocals made him a sex symbol in the 70s and 80s. He became an inspirational figure after a car accident left him paralyzed. He died yesterday, 8 months after colon cancer surgery. He was 59. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The death toll in Haiti continues to rise. Predictions of what it could be in the end are terrifying. According to Haitian officials, more than 100,000 are feared dead from Tuesday's 7.0 earthquake. Joining us now is Dixie Bickle. She owns an orphanage in Haiti about 12 miles outside the palace in Port-au-Prince. Good morning, Dixie.
Hello.
You care for children at your orphanage. What age are the children?
We have infants from a newborn to 12 years old. There's 150 of them in two separate houses, one for babies, one for the older children.
And is everyone okay? Is the orphanage still standing?
Kids were knocked down. The force of the shaking of the earthquake knocked children down. It knocked workers down and visitors that we had, but nobody was hurt. We had bumps and bruises, thankfully. The people around us, there was houses that were crushed, that collapsed, and there was a few people killed around us, but thankfully the orphanage held. And it swayed. It moved probably a good two feet back and forth during that whole 40 seconds. We couldn't walk in the house. It was very scary.
That's Dixie Bickle from her orphanage outside Port-au-Prince. We're also joined by Mark Lacey, New York Times Caribbean correspondent. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
You are still at the airport?
Yes, I'm still at the airport. Interestingly, it looks as though families are beginning to be evacuated. The French government appears to be loading some French nationals, their children, onto planes here at the airport. There are search and rescue teams from Los Angeles, from north of Fairfax, Virginia, who are on the scene here at the airport. There are rescue dogs that have been brought in, all sorts of equipment.
there's military personnel from around the world as well. So a lot of activity here at the airport.
Mark, does the relief effort appear to be coordinated?
There's a fair amount of chaos. It doesn't appear as though any one agency, any one government is in control. Interestingly, there appears to be no presence of the Haitian government here. The airport appears to be managed by the American Air Force, and I don't see any presence of Haitian government personnel. I apologize for the noise, but that is another aircraft coming in right behind me, loaded with relief supplies.
Okay, that's Mark Lacy, literally on the ground at the airport.
Yes.
Yeah, he's
waving
a New York Times Caribbean correspondent. Let's go back now to Dixie Bickle. She runs an orphanage outside Port-au-Prince with her husband, John. That orphanage is still standing. Thankfully, all of the children are okay. But, Dixie, the children are okay in the midst of chaos and disaster and death. How are the children handling what's going on around them?
They're doing very well. So many of our babies, so, you know, it's their routine is disrupted. A lot of my staff could not arrive to take care of them, but thankfully I have a lot of American and Canadian volunteers that are here that are stepping in for my Haitian staff. Yesterday we were able to get to Port-au-Prince to see what was going on there. We couldn't get all the way downtown, but we could get part of the way. There are bodies laying along the street. They're piled up. Blood is running in the gutters like water. It's running out of buildings that have collapsed and into the gutters. There's people are in shock. They're just in shock. Women holding dead babies that have died in a collapsed house. And people standing out in the open, they're out in parks, they're afraid to go back into their houses. The radio is telling them not to go in the houses, to stay out in the open. It's a disaster area down there. It looks like a bomb has gone off.
Do they know where to go for water? Are there places to go for water? Are they maybe coming to your orphanage
there
as one of the buildings?
We need humanitarian aid. Bottled water, fruit bars, granola bars, things that we can, ham sandwiches, anything we can hand out to them now. They need food now. They don't need rice because there's nowhere to cook the rice. They have nothing to cook on, or they lost everything, all their plates, all their clothing, their everything in their houses. They've got the clothes on their backs, and they're standing in the park.
Are you worried about food and water for the children in the orphanage that you run?
I am. We buy water, and today we've sent some of our staff out to see if the people we buy water from, it comes in a truck, and we buy 10 trucks a week for this orphanage, and we've sent people out to see if they can possibly deliver water to us, know if their office was damaged, if they're are even running. We depend on a generator, and we need diesel fuel for that, and we're almost out of diesel fuel. We have babies on oxygen here. If we don't get fuel to run our generator, some of those babies may not survive when we need it. It's those immediate things that we're thinking about. We have to, like we're saying, we're putting out fires now. We're in the sense of we're just trying to deal with the daily things that are coming up. We're not even planning for next week.
Well, hopefully some of those planes landing at the airport are bringing some much-needed help to you and the kids in your orphanage. That's Dixie Bickle, about 12 miles outside Port-au-Prince.
And the humanitarian horizon does look grim. We're asking our listeners, what is the responsibility of the world's richest nation in response to the devastating earthquake that has rocked the poor nation of Haiti? What do you think?
We need to come together and help this country as much as we can. But it seems that the Red Cross seems to be able to respond to tragedies much more quickly than any other country. So what we probably need to do is support them.
We're partially responsible for the fall of Haiti because we were responsible for the coup. So, yes, we should give humanitarian aid.
Or Suzanne Baker wrote on our website, it's not a question of whether we as Americans are responsible or should shoulder more of the burden. It's about our responsibility as human beings. What do you think? I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.